Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Senior Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we're going to feature a roundtable discussion for the inaugural Seizure Action Plan Awareness Week, taking place this very week, that our associate editor Marco Meglio had with a trio of experts. They include M. Scott Perry, the co-director of the Jane and John Justin Neurosciences Center at Cook Children's Hospital, Warren Davinsky, the director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center at NYU Langone, and Tracy Salazar, the executive director of the Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome Foundation, the three of which spoke to this initiative to raise awareness about the importance of developing SAPs for patients with epilepsy and their caregivers. Let's dive in.
Neurology Live Roundtable Discussion. Here with me today is Dr. Scott Perry, the co-director of the Jane and John Justin Neurosciences Center at Cook Children's Hospital, Orin Davinsky, the director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center at NYU Langone, and Tracy Salazar, who is the executive director of the Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome Foundation. This discussion is in collaboration with all three of our strategic alliance partners, including the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance, Dravet Syndrome Foundation, and LGS Foundation as well. Today's topic of discussion is on Seizure Action Plan Awareness Week and the importance of developing a seizure action plan. So with that being said, let's begin. Speaking generally, what is a seizure action plan and what are some of the benefits of developing one?
So for children with any form of epilepsy, there's always a concern that they can have a seizure. And I think the seizure could occur at home, it could occur at school, at a babysitter's. And so parents and any of the other individuals, from teachers and school nurses, should be aware of the types of seizure a child has and what would happen in the occasional case where a seizure is more intense, more prolonged, and how to administer first aid, number one, and then potentially, if needed, rescue medications to stop the seizure.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And to add to that, the other thing about seizure action plans is that every kid is different. And what needs action for every kid is different. So understanding for that individual what is an emergency situation, what is different for their epilepsy, and what needs intervention is really important. And that's another thing that seizure action plans bring.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think that everybody who has epilepsy should really have some sort of a seizure action plan. And if your epilepsy is relatively controlled or fully controlled, an emergency can still happen. So you should have that discussion with your doctor about what can happen. If you happen to be on the other end of the spectrum, which is where my family comes from and where most Lennox-Gastaut families are, we are having emergencies all of the time. And so what we really need is to understand what the pattern of seizures are in our loved one and how, if that's changing, which it often does over time, it would warrant us to use like an at-home emergency rescue medicine or to go to the emergency room. But it's like exactly as Dr. Perry said, it's individualized for each patient. But I do think everyone would benefit from having a written down plan of some kind that they've shared broadly when they're dealing with seizures in their life.
A recent study suggested that nearly 30% of adult patients with epilepsy have a seizure action plan. So why is that number so low? And what can we do to improve those rates?
So I take care of children and adults, and you're absolutely right. I think the vast majority of seizure action plans that get done are for children, in part because many schools require it. And obviously, once it's required, people and parents, doctors have to step up. The Epilepsy Foundation on their website has a great form of a seizure action plan that I tend to use as kind of the template and model. But I think for adults, it depends on the seizure frequency, but I agree with what Tracy said. Even if someone's been seizure free for 5 years, unfortunately, anyone with epilepsy can have a breakthrough from, you know, missing medications, not being able to absorb it due to a GI illness, food poisoning, something like that. And so there's always a potential risk. And I think it is good to discuss what, you know, caretaker, it could be a spouse for an adult, it could be a roommate or partner, or whatever. But I think adults should know, and the people around them should know what to do.
I think from where we sit, you know, last year we launched a four-part webinar series at the LGS Foundation, really to dig deep into the question of seizure action plans and rescue medicine therapies and what's going on in our community. Because we had surveyed our community and said, hey, you know, the biggest problem we're having in our community, in addition to seizures, because we're having seizures pretty much daily or weekly over here in the LGS world, is frequent clusters or frequent status and frequent injuries. And so as we dug in, we realized that our families, they hadn't really thought about it. Like, there's so much, they're mired in so much of the day-to-day of just living with, you know, constant crisis and constant seizures, that they hadn't thought, it was usually in the head, usually of mom, not always, but usually they hadn't written it down. They hadn't shared it. They hadn't really thought, they filled out the form for school, but they hadn't really thought about how that form could be used beyond school. Like, we use our seizure action plan. On the first page, we have a seizure emergency plan. This is the, listen, it's very likely the paramedics are going to get called. What are just the facts here, right? Like, there's no extraneous information. It's one page, what they're allergic to, what meds they're on, what's their baseline. And then we literally hand that when the 911 is called, you know, the paramedics, we hand that to the emergency paramedics and give it to them, and we don't have to repeat over and over. And when we get admitted, we handed it to the emergency room doctor. But that's different than what the school would have, right? The school needs a more comprehensive world picture and a view. And when we did this four-part series and we interviewed tons and tons of families about seizure action plans, we realized that a lot of families just hadn't even really thought to, like, they knew it in their head, they kind of knew it, it kind of changed, but they didn't really think about writing it down or necessarily even sharing it if they were co-parenting, like in a dual household, mom and one and dad the other. And so it really brought this awareness about on our end about, you know, just making sure that you understand that you know, if you get incapacitated, like what if you get COVID, which a number of our families have, that plan is shared broadly with the groups.
Obviously, you know, there are a ton of different types of epilepsies that range a lot of different severities of type of epilepsy. So are there specific epilepsy populations that benefit more from these plans? And if so, which ones and why?
I'll jump in on that one. My first response when somebody asked me, you know, who needs a seizure action plan is what we've already said. Everyone needs a seizure action plan. And frankly, I'm not even talking about people who have epilepsy. Knowing that the likelihood of having a seizure in your lifetime is pretty high, everyone should at least be aware of how to recognize and deliver first aid to a seizure. That should be everyone in the world's seizure action plan. Take it the next step to people who have epilepsy and have obviously a higher likelihood of having a seizure and needing a rescue plan. Certain conditions are much more prone to go into status and other emergencies. Obviously, Lennox-Gastaut is a great example. Dravet syndrome, another fine example. Many of the developmental epileptic encephalopathies that are out there, there's a number of them now, tend to have frequent seizures, seizure clusters, and prolonged seizures. And, you know, one of the important things, as I said before, about those seizure action plans is not just here are the steps, but I always start those seizure action plans with here is the syndrome. Now, this is the child, this is their condition, and this is what often happens in their condition. Dravet syndrome, for example, many people don't know what that is, you know, maybe they've never heard of that. And I need the healthcare providers to understand that this is a condition that's going to go into status very commonly. And so don't lollygag, all right? Here's the plan. Take this step, and if this amount of time has passed and the seizure is still going, you better take this step or we're going to get into a bigger emergency.
Yeah, and as Scott said at the outset, I think the concept of individualizing the plan, you know, can't be stressed enough. And Dravet, you know, is just a good example of where, especially when the kids are young and they've already, unfortunately, told you when they get a fever, they often go into status. Those are cases where, you know, many of us recommend for other children or adults not to administer a rescue medication until 3 or 5 minutes into a seizure, especially if they know that the seizure typically ends in 4 minutes. I would never give it a 3 minutes. But with Dravet, if a child has a history of status, especially with fever, for example, then I often recommend giving the rescue medication as soon as the parent can get it in. I kind of use the metaphor of a big rock rolling down a hill. If you catch it an inch after it starts rolling, it's easy to stop. But if you catch it half a mile down the mountain, you're roadkill.
So obviously, we have all been enwrapped with the COVID-19 pandemic, and we're still living in the COVID-19 pandemic. Even though there are vaccinations that are out and vaccinations that are on the way, we still have to be aware, especially with cases still rising and still the amount of deaths still in large numbers. So the COVID-19 pandemic has obviously had this great impact. How has it impacted seizure action plans specifically?
I think in our community, it's really highlighted the need and even more, because in our online private support groups, we've heard stories of parents getting COVID, right? Single parents getting COVID. And did you have your plan written down and now you have to be separated and isolated? Have you shared it? And so is the care for the person who has epilepsy seamless because now you're incapacitated? We've also heard stories of the person with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome or with epilepsy getting COVID, right? And that can change seizures. That can change the need for the plan to change and to review it. And so being able to carry the seizure action plan into the emergency room in many cases has increased the speed at which therapy is applied, right? Usually you end up in the emergency room because the seizure action plan didn't work, right? You give at-home rescue meds, and if at-home rescue meds don't work, you end up in the ER because they didn't work. But that the action plan really is a baseline for the emergency department to pick up and not waste time, as both Dr. Perry and Novinsky said. But we've also seen instances too where families are terrified to go into the ER with their kid. Nobody has COVID, but they're going to get COVID if they go to the ER. And we're used to going to the ER for seizures because we have a very, very difficult syndrome, just like Dravet. LGS is very, very difficult. Lots of status, lots of clusters. And so do they have the plans in place? Can they give at-home rescue so they don't have to expose themselves to the dangers of being in the hospital? So I think our community is more on alert than it's ever been, that they really need these plans in place and that they need to share them.
Yeah, that is exactly what I was going to say. That's the point of a seizure action plan, is to not go to the emergency department,
right?
Not end up in the hospital, right? The aim is to stay at home. And COVID has certainly made that a much higher desire to not have to go to the emergency room. So it just kind of reminds everybody of why we have these plans in place and why they're important to have.
We mentioned before about the adult plans, seizure action plans, and also the differences between children's seizure action plans. So can you guys go into a little bit more detail about the differences between different types of seizure action plans in terms of age, whether it's a child or an adult seizure action plan?
One of the big questions is who's around. So with children, usually you can be pretty confident that for the vast majority of their lives, especially for a lot of children with epilepsy, and especially some of the populations we're talking about, Lennox-Gastaut, Dravet, tuberous sclerosis, where there's associated intellectual issues for many of these children, they're watched most of the time. I think nighttime is a potentially dangerous time, and that's another issue. But typically they're at the parent's home, and there may be a monitoring device, even just a sound monitor. But I think for adults, it becomes a much more challenging issue for me. You have a 25-year-old man who lives alone in an apartment, working, has seizures, and, coming up with a seizure action plan is easy to write on paper, but someone's got to administer it. And if he's in his apartment alone on a Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. and has a seizure, I mean, that's a big challenge. And that gets to another part of the seizure action plan. What do you do in those cases? And it's hard. I think there can be things like a watch, whether it's the Apple Watch or the Empatica Embrace. But then if his parents live in Cleveland and he's working in New York City, alarming the parents is not going to be helpful. So it's going to have to be someone in his apartment building, something like that. So someone, a work colleague who lives nearby, but someone's got to be able to get there and attend to him. So it tends to be quite different in adults overall, I think, than kids. And kids are more prone to prolonged seizures than adults are.
I think you need, I mean, I think each seizure action plan, no matter where you exist on the spectrum, has some of the same basic components, right? You know, it's got like your name and your weight and your height and the meds you're on and the condition you have, right? Even if it's an adult temporal lobe epilepsy or a syndrome like the ones we've talked about, you know, what you're allergic to and what to do in case of emergency and what your pattern is. But sometimes you need to go into more detail on that. You know, it's like there were times where my daughter who has LGS, her pattern was to go into, nonstop seizures or into clusters a couple times a week. And we were trying medication management to change that. But then there were other times where she would go months without having to need a rescue med or to go into the emergency room. And so just making sure that you're up to date on that and you know what you're going to do and hope you never need it. And then on the other end of the spectrum, if you know you're going to need it, making sure that you understand when, you know, to interject it. We do have families that, you know, they're like, well, my kid normally has, you know, two seizures in the morning, but now they're on the fourth one. Do I wait till the fifth one to give the rescue? So making sure that you have that conversation with your physician and finding clarity on when you might give a rescue med. It's just all of that. And then having it written down. I mean, we are, at least in the world I live in with the severe syndromes, we're not seeing the whole big picture. We're in crisis all the time, right? I remember when I first learned about rectal diazepam, you know, this was probably about 20 years ago, but we had been living with epilepsy for 3 years before we learned that rescue had just come out on the market. And somebody took me by the shoulders and said, you need this. Cause I was like, no, I don't think I need it. She's like, I'm going to the ER, you know, pretty like a couple of times a month. You need this. And it's like, sometimes you just need to write it down. Because there's a lot going on in life to get above the noise of it all.
You know, Tracy, you brought up a good point that I just, before I forget about it, want to speak on, is that things change. So a seizure action plan is not something that you necessarily are required to only visit once a year, you know, when you go visit your neurologist. Seizure patterns change, seizure types, seizure frequencies change. So it is important if things like that change to touch base with the provider to see, is the seizure action plan going to be different? Because, you know, maybe your kid right now is having very short seizures. They're spread about by a certain amount of time. In between, they're okay. Maybe the rescue medicine's not being used there. But if those seizures are now becoming closer together and there's an alteration of awareness in between, that's a different situation. Maybe we want to use a rescue medicine at that point. So it's always important to kind of revisit if the pattern has changed. It's definitely important to revisit it on a yearly basis because at least in pediatrics, weight changes. So it's always important to make sure that the rescue medicine we have provided and planned for is actually the appropriate dose for your current weight and situation, because that may be a reason why it doesn't work if we're not on top of that and making sure we're staying in the right ranges.
And to switch gears a little bit, and this may be a little bit more geared towards Tracy, but how can advocacy organizations assist in building seizure action plans or assist with at least the education of seizures in general?
Yeah, no, I think the advocacy organizations are really fantastic at doing this. And as Oren mentioned, the Epilepsy Foundation has a great seizure action plan toolkit, a whole toolkit on their website. And then we've recently partnered with a bunch of advocacy organizations as part of the Seizure Action Plan Coalition. Coming up very soon, there's going to be awareness campaign around Seizure Action Plan, Seizure Action Plan Awareness Week. And I think that, you know, no matter where you fall on the spectrum, whether you're the 25-year-old man who lives alone in New York, whose parents live in Cleveland, or you're the really severe, you know, child like my daughter who's having seizure episodes all the time because it's a difficult syndrome, you can agree that there should have some sort of a seizure action plan. And so the Awareness Week is really just about, do you have one? Is it individualized for you? Have you talked to your doctor about it? Have you written it down? And have you shared it with somebody near you in case, you know, things go down and things go down from time to time? You know, if you're the 25-year-old man in New York, you would have the insulin handy if you had diabetes, right? So you might want to have this handy if you're, you know, if you a rescue med or a plan at least in place. So it's really just preparing for an emergency. So I hope everybody will check out the Seizure Action Plan Coalition. You can learn more about that. And we have resources on there. We're linking out to Epilepsy Foundation's resource. We're linking out to specific resources just for the very severe. It really is just get a plan. And so that's one way where we can try to educate and work with our physicians out there that are really trying to help make this happen for our families so they have plans.
You guys mentioned before about implementing these seizure action plans as soon as possible, especially in a pediatric age. So can you guys talk a little bit about if or what barriers are faced by families in implementing these seizure action plans in the educational system specifically?
So, I can say one of the problems you run into depends on what the seizure action plan is, like what are the steps and what it includes, right? Because you are basically, when we're talking about school, I'm providing them a list of things I would like them to do, which may end with, here's a medicine I want to give you. Now, that's gotten a little easier recently because we have many more rescue medicines than we had available to us before. Before we had some meds we could give by mouth. We had rectal diazepam. Some of us used nasal medication, midazolam, but it wasn't in a official FDA approved version. And that's probably where I ran into the most problems in school because I was using a medicine that wasn't FDA approved per se. And it took some steps. They had to draw it up. They had to make it into a way that it became a spray. A lot of steps. Maybe I was asking too much, right? So it's much easier now that we actually have FDA approved versions of nasal medicines plus rectal medicines plus these oral medications. Obviously, the other barrier is people are nervous and scared, right? So you can give them an action plan, but that doesn't take care of the fact that they may still be nervous and scared about what they're going to do. There's several states out there that are doing a great job. I will, toot the horn of the state of Texas, who has made it officially required for seizure recognition and seizure first aid training to be part of all school personnel to have. It's equally as important as basic life support. And understanding that and getting them over the fear of recognizing and knowing what to do when a seizure happens is probably the one of the best steps one could take to make sure that action plan gets acted upon.
I agree. I think for our families, it's a lot easier now, but it was always a challenge to get rectal medicine administered because it's rectal. But also these are powerful medications and there is a lot of fear. So training is the best way that you can go with that. And I know that Epilepsy Foundation is doing a lot of work with Seizure Safe Schools and making sure that we really promote that same kind of education across the entire U.S., educating our schools about not to be afraid of seizures, not to be terrified of, consequences or liability, which is often what happens with our kids, who just need safety medicine, right? But to be educated and know how to deal with the situation.
Obviously, epilepsy specifically in general, there is the period of transition between the childhood and the adulthood stage where you change from a child neurologist to an adult neurologist or an adult epilepsy specialist. So can you guys talk a little bit about the importance of stressing these seizure action plans during that transition period?
Well, I think the transition period in general is a dangerous time for many children and adolescents with epilepsy who are now going into early adulthood, because pediatrics in general is a nurturing environment. Physicians, general pediatricians, pediatric neurologists, pediatric epileptologists, it tends to be, a relatively encompassing practice. And all of a sudden, a lot of adult practices, especially in communities, but even in epilepsy centers, I think are busier. The schedules are busy, visits are shorter. And sometimes a nurse or a nurse practitioner, if you're lucky, will help out and supplement the doctor in following up. But so there are two problems. One is I think there's issues with the handoff. A lot of people just graduate from a pediatric neurologist, you're 18, you're 21, you're 24 now. I've got to really, we're not supposed to see you at our institution after age 21. And so then you get referred to an epileptologist who may be at a great academic institution. But again, some of those clinics are busier. Sometimes maybe a nurse practitioner who does most of the visit, not the epileptologist, and they're also busy. So I do think, having parents connect, hopefully the doctors connect themselves, and there is a good handoff between the pediatric and the adult neurologist or epileptologist. But the same with the action plan. The circumstances and the life situation. So, for example, a lot of my patients with Lennox-Gastaut may transition to a group home at some point from, you know, living with their parents, maybe at 25, maybe at 40. But that transition is an important one. And again, the parents often stay involved for a period of time intensely, but then they may move to Florida or whatever. One of them may die and one of them, you know, may get a medical disorder that limits them. So all those handoffs and the seizure action plan is a critical part of it for all of that.
I think it was really hard for us when we transitioned from pediatric care to adult care, because pediatric doctors, pediatric neurologists and epileptologists are trained as pediatricians first, which is more of a whole body care, right? It's the whole system. Whereas an adult neurologist is really trained around the adult brain, right? And so, you know, they're not really thinking about the, you know, the bowels as much, right? Even if the medicine they put you on gives you constipation, that is not their problem, right? Like, it's like, I'm the brain doctor, right? And so it was really surprising for us to sort of learn that. So we had to coordinate care between the neurologist and, you know, the GI doctor and the psych doctor, because there's behaviors, aggressive behaviors and issues. But then everybody was sort of afraid of all the medicines that the neurologist had this kid on. And so everything kind of came down to the neurologist, right? But I think just it's about communication. It's about recognizing that the adult system is a little bit different. It's about making sure the handoff really happens. I do know it's, I agree with Warren, it's a very difficult, it's a very scary time. And if you don't have, if you have a constantly evolving syndrome like LGS or Dravet, it can be a very dangerous time if you don't have that continuity of care. So making sure the handoff happens appropriately so that there's no risk of further brain damage or death, I think is really crucial.
Is there a specific age that you guys would recommend that people immediately start looking into, or epileptic patients start looking into seizure action plans? Is there a minimum age that you would say that children need to at least have one to start?
Sure. Day of life, zero.
Zero was my number two.
Dr. Perry is going to line them up and start teaching sort of seizure first aid at, you know, age one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that seizure action plan may not consist of a home rescue medicine per se, because some of the medicines we have right now available to us are not really intended for that age group, right? But they can still have emergencies. So the family and whoever's taking care of the baby needs to understand what would be an emergency, what would prompt you to, you know, to exercise your seizure first aid plan, bring the kid to the emergency department, call EMS, you know, whatever. So yeah, plan starts whenever the seizure starts, no matter what the age is.
Is there anything else that you guys would like to mention on the topic of seizure action plans or things of note?
I was going to say, my thought for everybody is that epilepsy is a team sport. That means doctors are involved, the nurses are involved, the parents are involved, the patients are involved, everyone is involved. So do not rely on someone else to take care of this problem for you. Advocate for yourself to make sure if you don't have a seizure action plan, you're asking for one. Because I can tell you as a doctor, like Oren said, we're moving from room to room and trying to see the patients. And sometimes things like that will slip our mind, even though it's incredibly important. We think so much about the daily meds and trying to fix the seizures that we forget to look back to say, oh, wait, do you have a plan for if something goes wrong? So just be aware of that. Don't feel that you can't speak up.
You know, one thing that happens, you know, that I've seen, not a lot, but it definitely happens. And I'm just reminded because I have a young adult with her mom, probably 30-year-old woman with very severe epilepsy. And, you know, there can be overuse of rescue medications as well. And, you know, this mom would, you know, literally woke up her daughter at 4 or 5 a.m. in the epilepsy monitoring unit. The daughter was very hard to awaken. In part, she's on a lot of meds and she was sleeping. And the mother literally went into a panic attack, you know, understandably. And she's a very wonderful, loving mom that she, you know, she would normally give her daughter Diastat. She uses both a nasal spray for some and Diastat. It's been a, you know, she's got strong feelings on using it, and she gives a lot. And this was not a seizure. And I see the same thing in some populations like CDKL5, where, you know, kids can just have some, you know, movements in sleep, and the parents will rush in and spray the nostril with a rescue medication. And it's like, you know, that number one, I'm not sure it was a seizure. And number two, if it was, it was on the very mild spectrum and probably doesn't need rescue medications. And the problem with that, and then sometimes parents are giving it totally appropriately. You've got a kid with Lennox-Gastaut or Dravet who really has bad epilepsy, frequent seizures, despite best medical management. And then they just, it's like, well, they know if they give the rescue med, it stops a seizure and it just feels good to do it. The problem is if you do that 6 times in 3 days, then on the next day, when you don't give the rescue meds, you'll get an even bigger seizure from withdrawal. And it's those things really need to be discussed with the family or patient and the doctor. Last follow-up to Scott's point on, you know, for kids, and I think it's true for adults, need to, you know, reevaluate plans on a regular basis. The other thing that really can change a plan and dosing sometimes is if a medication gets started that's in the same family as the rescue med. So these medicines tend to be in the benzodiazepine family. And, you know, it used to be most of the benzodiazepines that were used were rescue meds like diazepam. Nowadays, with clobazam approved for epilepsy and being used a lot in treatment-resistant epilepsies in all the syndromes we've been discussing, if a child was never on a benzodiazepine and now is on clobazam, for example, and especially if they're on a moderate to high dose, they often need higher doses of rescue medications because their receptors are desensitized to the medication. And the dose that would normally work will no longer work for someone who's receiving daily benzodiazepine.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with Oren, and I think that we could really use some education in the patient space about what overuse of rescue medicine does look like, because I'm not sure. I mean, if you're using rescue meds on a regular basis, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, they have really bad epilepsy, it's LGS. It's another thing to say, we need a different treatment. This is not okay, you know, to be giving it weekly, and finding the balance between that, because LGS is a very difficult beast. So is Dravet. But I guess I would just, to answer your question, Marco, just say, you know, if you're a patient wherever you are and you have epilepsy, to learn more about seizure action plans, you can go to the Epilepsy Foundation website, or you can go to the Seizure Action Plan Coalition website, seizureactionplans.org. Help us spread awareness about seizure action plans. If you have epilepsy, talk to your doctor about getting a seizure action plan, you know, and then just making sure you know what to do. And hopefully you never need to implement an emergency plan. But if you do, you know what to do. And if you're overusing your emergency plan, that's also a conversation to be had. But there are tools out there to get educated. And I think that patients should do that. And I think that everyone in the world, as Dr. Perry said, should get seizure recognition and first aid training, just so you know what to do if someone has a seizure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.